Welcome back to Deep Thoughts, ladies and gentlemen. I hope you have good weather wherever you are. But given that these YouTube videos and vid.me videos can sit online for a really long time, you could be seeing this in the wintertime. As you can see, this episode is going to be about a movie that, unlike Rollerball, is not necessarily a giant prophecy of what's to come. It's just one of the coolest movies on planet Earth. But it's seldom understood by the younger audiences that, for no fault of their own, they believe it is sort of a copy of things that they've seen more recently. So we're going to have some fun here. I just remembered I've got an acquaintance of mine's book written on the subject. If you like the movie Blade Runner already, then there's a book you need to purchase if you don't already have it. It's called Future Noir, The Making of Blade Runner. It's written by Paul Samon, S-A-M-M-O-N. I've had dinner with Paul a couple times, been to a car show with him. Very cool dude. So we have a couple things here. We're going to have the normal storyline of Blade Runner. I'm going to tell you some of the reasons why it's become an heirloom to me, just like Rollerball 1975. By the way, it doesn't have the number 75 in it, but I have to distinguish it from its prequel, which was painful, even though it stars a friend of mine. We've never talked about that, and I hope that doesn't have to come up, so I don't have to say anything about it. But there's a little known fact, meaning very few people know this particular fact, but it has been communicated to the creators of the film, at least several of them, that there are three films that have been protected in a sort of Iron Mountain vault, like a Vault Tech system, that if we're to ever experience some sort of man-made cataclysm, three films will survive: Wizard of Oz, Gone with the Wind, and Blade Runner. And the interesting thing is, Blade Runner is not even in the top 20 films, grossing films. I'm not even sure it's in the top 100. And what's interesting about it is, for those who know the film, you usually love the film. Blade Runner is sort of like Shakespearean writing. The one thing you never get caught doing in this world is insulting Shakespeare. That's a no-no. And one thing you don't do is insult Blade Runner. Now, I have some friends of mine that made competing science fiction films, and they'll say something bad about Blade Runner, but we know where their criticism comes from. So let's get into it. I'm going to tell you some of the principles, or the foundational things about the film that's very interesting, and then I'm going to start kind of cruising through the film very lightly, because it is definitely something to experience if you didn't know. The film is directed by Ridley Scott. Ridley Scott was known for being a commercial director in the UK, Scotland, European area. He had filmed, as I was told, thousands of commercials, but having friends that have filmed commercials nonstop for 30 years and they're nowhere near 1,000, I find that number to be very inflated. But he also shot the famous 1984 Apple commercial that you saw. This was long after these films were made. But his first film was Alien, which we can all usually contest is one of the most amazing films of its kind. It was the first film to create really a super serious, scary film with an alien in it. And I know that I don't have the cultural ability to appreciate what was done in the 50s and perhaps maybe a couple films in the 60s. But by 1979, when we saw H.R. Giger's Alien come alive in Alien under the watchful guide of Ridley Scott, it was a different experience than everything else we'd ever seen. It set the bar higher, and the bar stayed there forever. So there's an interesting story about Blade Runner because it is based on a novel written by Philip K. Dick called Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep? But the story usually stops there for people. And the most interesting thing is the true story of how that became a film. Because Philip K. Dick is a very interesting individual. I mean, almost alien to our world in human form. He wrote about futures that no one could conceive of. Dark futures, serious futures. And he wasn't well as a human being. He sort of exuded his physical prowess. He's a big guy. I guess he's about 6'3", with sort of that writer's hump. Ultra brilliant. If you got to know him, he was sweet. If you didn't know him, you might think he was a jerk. That's just the rumors. Philip K. Dick is on record for predicting the future, just like Nostradamus, including having a vision of his child having a tangled intestine. And he grabs his child literally out of his wife's hand, says, "We have to go to the hospital right now. Our child's about to die." He goes to the hospital. He points at it. He names all the organs in the body that are having this problem. Having never gone to med school, having never written a book that required him to learn that anatomy, they did ultrasound on him, found out it was exactly what Philip had been given as a vision. They did the surgery. They told him, "Well, your son wasn't in imminent danger, as in hours and days, but he was probably in imminent danger as in months. How on earth did you know this was the case, and how did you know all the medical terms to communicate with us?" And he just said, "I don't know. It just came to me." So Philip K. Dick, to start out with, is the genesis of this film. And it just keeps getting more amazing and more amazing. And I happen to be very privileged to be in the center of a lot of the creativity that made this film. And so I'm going to share some of that with you guys as well, just sort of like maybe some Paul Harvey's in there for you. But a writer named Hampton Fincher, who I believe also wrote Unforgiven, as it was communicated to me, he's a stuntman who wanted to become a writer. And so he found this really cool book, and he went to Philip K. Dick, and he optioned the book. And I can't remember what he paid, but it was nearly nothing. And Philip K. Dick said, "Fine, whatever. You know, I know how Hollywood works. They're never going to be interested in this film, just so you know. So don't get your hopes up." And this Hampton guy, who I've met, he kept giving scripts to Philip K. Dick, which is what you do. You keep the writer informed about how you've evolved it, and you get their input and that kind of stuff. But then eventually, Philip K. Dick sort of got annoyed because he likes his privacy, and he tells Hampton, you know, "Stop bothering me, kid." Little W.C. Fields there. "Get away from me, kid. You're bothering me." And so he does. He complies, and he continues writing the story. And to his astonishment, as a first-time writer, he gets his script into the right hands at the right time. You know, we had Close Encounters, Star Wars. We had just all kinds of neat stuff happening, Alien. So in 1980, this thing is fully greenlit. Ridley Scott is interested in directing it. And they start making this film. Now, I'm going to take you down this whole storyline, and then we'll keep pulling back to the beginning. But they make the entire film, and Philip K. Dick gets wind that they've made the movie. And they're calling it Blade Runner, which is not his name. It's not in his book. And he's angry. He's angry that he wasn't informed that it was actually greenlit and made into a film. And he starts doing, I guess, radio interviews, telephone interviews with radio stations, because he's kind of ill, he's at home, and he starts really taking a crap on this film, telling people, "They did this behind my back, don't go see this film. Just out of honor, if you like me, out of my honor, don't go see this film." And really, Scott finds out and during the editing process and post-production that the founder of this story, of which he had no idea existed, is now pissed at him. And so really he's like, you know, who dropped the ball? Get him in here. Give him a VIP first-class ticket from wherever he lives and get him out here to Sony Studios where we're cutting this film up, and we'll give him a tour of the studios. We'll show him what we've got. And so he does. Philip K. Dick gets on a plane, flies to L.A. I think he was living in Texas, but I'm not quite sure. He lands with his wife. They give him a full tour of Sony Studios, MGM, and he doesn't give a crap. He doesn't care. He comes into the screening room. Ridley Scott has 23 minutes of the film cut together. He rolls it. Now, Vangelis was the musician on the final movie, but they didn't have any of his original work for the film finished, so they ran other Vangelis music behind it. And it was, you know, breaking here and there, I guess, for dialogue and then some of the more crazy, cool special effects scenes. But they get done with this reel. And it's just Philip K. Dick, his wife to his left, and Ridley Scott to the right, and the admins in the back rolling the projector. And the story goes is that he turns to Ridley Scott and he says, "Can we do that again?" And he says, "Do what?" And he goes, "Can you play it again?" He's like, "Yeah, oh sure, man, play it." They played all the way through again. And then Philip K. Dick turns to Ridley Scott and says, "How did you do that?" And Ridley goes, "Do what?" And he says, "You just created a movie that looked exactly the way I saw it in my head when I wrote the book, The Android Dream of Electric Sheep." I believe it's plural, androids. They shake hands, everything's great. There's still more editing that needs to be done before the film's going to be finished, and there's obviously a lead time to get into the theaters, and so it took a little while to get the film done. Philip K. Dick goes home and continues to suffer whatever illness got him in the end. He's then admitted to the hospital. He's taking interviews now as fast as he can to undo his damage, telling people, "This is going to be one of the most amazing movies you've ever seen. Go see it, especially if you like my books." Because Ridley Scott nailed it. The last known words of Philip K. Dick were uttered over the telephone to his attorney in his hospital bedroom, and he said, "I can't wait to get out of here and see Blade Runner. It's going to be amazing," right? Something to that degree, something to that effect, right? Hangs up the phone and dies in his hospital bed. Now, obviously, there's a chance he saw it. He just saw it in a different form. But the movie comes out, and it's starring Harrison Ford. Harrison Ford is Han Solo at the time. Harrison Ford is Indiana Jones at the time. And here he shows up in this obscure science fiction movie, right? For those of you who don't know the difference, sci-fi is science fantasy, which is more Star Wars. And science fiction is very serious based on science, right? It's supposed to be completely, it could be a prophecy if you base it on science fiction. In this film, it is dark, it is wet, it's constantly raining. There are fights, there's an American crew liaisoning with a British crew. Ridley Scott, when filming in the UK and Europe, there's a completely different demeanor between the crew and the director. The director is essentially sort of the president of the production, and you just say, "Yes, sir, no, sir," and you do your thing. There's not a lot of, "Hey, man, I had this idea, man." You know, like when there's this thing happening. That's what happens in Hollywood. A little more versatile. So when the two groups came together, there was sort of this ongoing fight between the two of them. All kinds of funny things were going on. But initially, Harrison Ford hated having been in this film because he wasn't treated the way he was being treated by American sets. And I would imagine a lot of things happened that are not written down in any books anywhere that, you know, we really don't have the right to criticize or get, you know, really cast an opinion. But something didn't jive between Harrison Ford and Ridley Scott. And so when it was over, he wouldn't take any interviews about it, wouldn't talk about it. I was a fan of his due to the other franchises, and I never heard him talk about it. And then somewhere in the early 90s, an individual was appropriating a bunch of old film reels, deciding whether or not they should be digitized or not, at, I can't remember, probably Warner Brothers Studios. And he finds a director's cut of the original Blade Runner that was in extremely nice condition. And so he elects it to obviously be digitized. And that's where we got the Blade Runner DVD from. We're going to go back. We're going to keep coming back. So don't worry if I'm missing stuff. Don't worry about it. But that was when it franchised up and blew up as a bona fide cult film outside of the, you know, few tens of thousands of us that really got into it in the 80s. It turned into a 100,000 million person phenomenon in the 90s and just kept going and going until the point where Warner Brothers said, you know, let's talk about a sequel or prequel or something. Let's talk about it because this is wild. And finally, I think enough people whispered in Harrison Ford's ear something to this effect. Harrison, Blade Runner is the best theatrical performance you have ever performed. It is your best moment on camera in your entire career. Not the most necessarily, you know, exciting, fanciful. It's not you being Han Solo and kicking ass and taking names. It's not you being Indiana Jones and kicking ass and taking names and all those other weird Tom Clancy kind of movies you made. But this was sophisticated and you pulled it off. You pulled off a character that was in a weird world and we believed it from start to finish. And you do. Harrison kills this role. I always say kill. People say nailed. Kill usually might mean bad, but no, this is not bad meaning bad, but bad meaning good. And so in the last 5 years, we've seen a reemergence of Harrison Ford in respect to Blade Runner, and he's finally talking about it. Now here, this year we're going to get the sequel. And, you know, dear God, I hope it's good. I hope it's good. The inside rumors are that it's a fabulous script. And I can definitely tell you, having purchased the original script that Hampton Fincher and another guy finished off, the beginning of the trailer looks like a beginning of the actual original script, which never was actually created because it was going to cost too much money. So let's hope that the sequel is pretty good. But now let's rewind back to the beginning. What you may or may not know is that this film went through an unbelievable challenge to be funded. This film went bankrupt essentially twice, causing it to split into three pieces, right? You take a ribbon and you chop it in two places, you get three pieces, right? So it was initially greenlit for $10 million, which is really pathetic because Ridley Scott had just directed Alien, which made about $110 million in the end domestically, as I understand it, which back in 1979 was huge money. It wasn't Star Wars money, but it wasn't anything to sneeze at. So he gets $10 million. And because of the fabrication that was necessary to make the world happen, they got through that really quick. They're not hiring crappy actors, and so they're spending tons of money. And so they have to go get more money. And once they got more money, they had to change production companies. They actually had to change the lot in which they were filming because of the change in the funding. Then it went bankrupt again at $20 million. Had to borrow another $10 million. And this time they had to borrow outside of the paradigm of filmmaking. If you ever watch Blade Runner, you'll see this really cool logo of this digitized tree, like a mustard tree or something. That's actually probably the name of the tree is the logo. I can't remember what the hell the name of the company is. But it was a company just of some investors who are probably some of the luckiest people on planet Earth because they did invest in Blade Runner. And they finally finished up the film. But over the course of all this ups and downs, you actually have a situation that happened to Steven Spielberg during the filming of Close Encounters of the Third Kind that Ridley Scott got actually fired, technically speaking, on paper. Some of you may not know, but Steven Spielberg was fired off of Close Encounters while filming the Devil's Tower segments, and both of them did the same thing. They just kept coming to work. So one of the nightmares on paper, when it came to distributing the film, was trying to divide up all the dollars and cents from these companies that go belly up. Two different studios that were huge that participated in its creation, wanting their percentage, and who knows what the percentages were. So I would say that the executive producers on Blade Runner really did their job. and I've met several of them, and I've acquaintances with a lot of them. But they're amazing people that kept pursuing this thing through. Let's rewind back to the beginning. Blade Runner looks different than all science fiction films made up until 1982. And it can be credited to a very good friend of mine that I've worked for 20 years. His name is Sid Mead. S-Y-D-M-E-A-D. You just go to sidmead.com. You can take a look at some of his wares there. He's still a working artist, so there's not like a greatest hits on that website. And he still does movies all the time. And I can't say anything else about that. He's a working artist. But Sid was introduced to Ridley Scott by another very, very close friend of mine, Richard Taylor from Tron. And this is a very interesting story, which I do not believe is in the Future Noir book. But I have the inside scoop, so you get the inside scoop, and this is how it goes. So Richard Taylor is working on Tron, the 1982 release of Tron. And again, they have very similar green light dates and release dates. So you have 1982 is when Tron released in August and Blade Runner released in Christmas. And Tron was supposed to release in Christmas, so it's probably a good thing that they got separated from each other. But Richard Taylor is sitting in his studio working on Tron. And Richard Taylor, there's two Richard Taylors that are big special effects guys. One works for Weta, for Peter Jackson, and he's younger. And the other one is older, my buddy, and he was the one that actually invented the striped line look in Tron. So that whole lit line thing, which he invented at a place called Abels and Associates, he called it Candy Apple Red when he invented it, using a bunch of rear projection technology. But when Steven Lisberger went to Richard Taylor and said, I'm not sure what this thing should look like. We're making the inside of a computer, and nobody even has computers in their homes yet, so what should it look like? And he goes, hey, I got an idea. And so they figured out how to do the Tron look, which is now in your cars, right? My car looks like a Tron world inside because it's all pinstriped, and I can change the color of the pinstripes in 9 different colors in my car. All due to the guy who sits in it every once in a while, which is pretty cool. But there's a point, and I'm not quite sure how this happens, but you have a point where Ridley Scott was coming down the hallway and ends up sitting with Richard Taylor at his office, and he is trying to figure out who can design Blade Runner, because he has all these things that he needs to do, and the very first thing he needs to get designed are the cars. And Sid Mead has been a prodigy. I'll probably do a whole episode on Sid at one point. But he has been a prodigy since he was a child in terms of illustration. He went to Art Center, designed for Ford and Phillips. Then he broke out on his own, did the U.S. Steel series, and then he got into film with Star Trek, which Richard and Sid bumped shoulders in Star Trek, the first film, motion picture, 1979. But Ridley's sitting there with Richard, and he goes, I don't know what to make this world. I got to make these cars right away. And so Richard says, have you heard of Sid Mead? He goes, no, who's that? Well, he's got his U.S. Steel series, which what it was is U.S. Steel Company, which still exists to this day, hired Sid to do beautiful fantasy renderings of where you could use steel. And so Sid would design all kinds of homes and cars. In fact, the AT-AT walkers that are in Empire Strikes Back are actually lifted from a painting in 1962 by Sid for the U.S. Steel. And he didn't have the top part of it figured out, but he had the legs in the snow. And it's just, when you see the rendering by Sid, you'll go, oh my God, you know, this came from the same dude. But he hands Ridley a couple of his U.S. Steel books, and Ridley left. And Sid got a phone call. Now, Sid was already hired and working on Tron, sharing the task with Mobius. So Tron gets created by Sid Mead in 50% capacity, and in Tron, Sid did the tanks, the light cycles. He did the circuitry design, where Mobius did more of the body design. Mobius did the solar sailor. I think a different group did the recognizer. But once you see you know, the tank in Tron 1 back in 82, your jaw's on the ground, how amazing this thing. And of course, it was rendered by some unbelievable artists at three different studios back in the day, so there's a whole bunch of people participating in that, but Sid was the genesis. And when Tron Legacy was made in 2010, the original design that Sid had for the bikes and the light cycles was more like the 2010 one than the one you saw in 82, but the software in 82 couldn't do it. It couldn't make the guy's body blend in with the bike. So if you see the original sketch that Sid did back in 81, you'll see the huge resemblance with Legacy. Except Sid's, I think, is a little cooler in some respects. Well, BMW designed the light cycles in Legacy, which is why they're so freaking cool. But anyway, back to Blade Runner. One of the funny stories was that Richard never got back his U.S. Steel books. And because they are so rare and they're so limited edition, and people fight to get them even to this day. And what's really strange is if you go to flea markets in big cities, sometimes you'll find these books being sold for $5, $10, and they're worth hundreds of dollars. So for those of you who are collectors, you might add that to your list of very special things. But Sid gets hired to do the cars. And every single vehicle that you see that's a space-age vehicle, like the Spinner, the cop car, Deckard's cop car, and a few of the other ambient cars that are in traffic, built by Gene Winfield, those are all Sid's. But then what Sid was doing is, Sid doesn't just create an image of a product. So if you said, hey, I want you to design a salt shaker, Sid won't just do the salt shaker. He puts it on a table. He puts it at a picnic. He puts it at some futuristic picnic. He designs something cool on the wall. The clothing is all new. The table's strange and designed. So he starts turning in paintings of these vehicles with these exteriors, futuristic exteriors. And Ridley Scott's like, well, where did you get the direction to do the buildings? And he said, nothing. No one told me. I do scenario. I don't do products. I make a scenario in a painting. There's composition. There's action. There's a storyline. And Ridley goes, okay, this looks perfect. Why don't you start doing everything? The clothing, the guns, the interiors of buildings, the exteriors of the buildings. So he did like J.F. Sebastian's interior. Sid's original sketch of Sebastian's laboratory was simply too expensive to create, but it would have made the movie even more intense. Even though there's no real flaws in Blade Runner for the time, Sid's always outpacing what the studios can afford, usually. So we have this genesis, this amazing set of circumstances that kicks this film off. Hampton Fincher, you know, stuntman, goes and grabs a book, licenses it, writes for about 5 years, is in the right place at the right time. Ridley Scott gets in, gets hired. Sid gets in, gets hired. Philip K. Dick is angry. Then he sees it, and he's completely convinced it's the most amazing thing he's ever seen. But the gentleman who wrote this book, Future Noir, The Making of Blade Runner by Paul Simon, he was hired at the very beginning of this process to document the creation of this movie. And in my entire history of listening to, you know, my buddies making their films, very few studios have ever had enough insight to hire someone to do such a thing. And so this book is utterly packed with all the secrets, all the wild craziness that went on, the disputes and all that kind of stuff, right? But why is Blade Runner special? Well, if you're a fan of old gumshoe detective movies from the 30s, there's this crazy similarity between that, which is usually film noir, right? You know, film noir comes from a French sort of stylistic method of making films. When we brought it over here, you have Humphrey Bogart and James Cagney making films. And so there's this private detective who's our guy, played by Harrison Ford, whose name's Deckard, who's named after Descartes, the philosopher. And he is approached at the beginning of this film to handle a case of some replicants, which are what they call androids, who are perfectly lifelike, perfectly human-like, who have escaped from a mining colony and come back to Earth for an unknown reason. There was five of them originally. One of them gets fried up in a security gate, and then you have four left. Two girls and two boys. You have a few famous actors in this film, right? You've got Rutger Hauer playing Roy. You have Daryl Hannah playing Pris. You have Sean Young playing one of the assistants to Dr. Terrell, who's the main guy that designs all of these androids. You have Edward James Olmos playing Gath. I mean, Edward, you know, James Olmos just blew up after this whole thing, right? An actor named Brian James, who was actually also in The Fifth Element, who just before the filming of his first scene, which is an interview with the Terrell Corporation, he had gotten into a major motorcycle accident and was very serious, and his face is all scraped up from the motorcycle accident, and so they just left it in the film because he works at the Terrell Corporation, and you know, they had just kind of busted out of this mining colony and came back to Earth and killed a few guards, and so they just kind of left it in, and it worked completely. William Sanderson, who you have seen in the TV series Coach, but he was in Deadwood as E.B. Farnham, you know, just exploded off this movie, right? The very famous James Hong, who plays Chu, who's an expert that makes eyes, which is really cool. Joe Turkle, who was the bartender in The Shining with Stanley Kubrick, ends up being Dr. Terrell, and he's just one of the most debonair, amazing guys you'll ever see, and he's still alive to this day. Jonah Cassidy, who I've actually met at one of the Warner Brothers gatherings, she plays Zora, who's one of the super badass BattleBot chicks, which is really cool. And again, they all look normal human, right? So you have this incredible staff, and every other person in the film is phenomenal as well. There's no bad acting in the entire film. So you already have this sort of match made in heaven with the formula of the casting. There's another historical thing about this film that a lot of people don't know about, and that is that the studios, such as Warner Brothers, Paramount, and all the people that come together to make films happen at the time, were at the peak of their skill sets. Ridley Scott was at the peak of his skill set. People who made movies back in those days actually had worked together for 10, 20, 30 years, and so when they wanted to get a concept about what needed to happen, when Ridley's trying to tell someone what he's seeing in his head, the staff was a lot more equipped back in those days to get his vision out. Because everyone worked together, they could intercommunicate really, really well. Today, everything is a consulting firm. So you have studios that have kicked everyone out of the studios and they make them all consult in, meaning every film that's created today is a hodgepodge of folks that have maybe worked together, maybe not worked together. Maybe they like each other, maybe they don't like each other. And so it's always this sort of balancing game when you build your crew today. But back in the day, you would carry your crew with you from a major studio because you would have signed a contract with Warner Brothers or signed a contract with someone, and you would carry this family with you. Stanley Kubrick, who remained independent his whole life, had built a crew. I think by the time A Clockwork Orange was made, he finally found the staff that he liked, because 2001 was a definite hodgepodge of all kinds of folks coming together to make an amazing film, right? So the quality of the film has that going for it. Now, let's talk about some of the stylistic treatments that were the foundation of the film that had never been really done before, that film. And you might cite some bizarre film, but this is where it really came together and was executed at an A-plus level, right? 100% plus extra credit. You have a dark future. At most, we had the Rebel Force in Star Wars up to that point where they, you know, had the intelligence to say if it's a rebel force, they don't have all the resources and they're not going to have fresh paint jobs and fresh equipment, and they're not going to have giant motherships and bases all polished. And so that was the first kind of step in that direction. But Philip K. Dick had been writing what you see in Blade Runner for at least 20 years prior. Again, this dude was seeing a future that we just weren't seeing. And it's Los Angeles 2019. Again, their movie was released in 1982. I think the only bummer that they did when they remastered it was not to, they should have added an extra 100 years, and then it really would have been interesting to the young kids. So any young kid who plays a movie that's going to happen in 2 years from today, 2017 to 2019, it already seems hokey and ridiculous. So they should have flipped it up 2019. But anyway, so it's 2019, Los Angeles area. And Los Angeles has turned into the refinery that we have here in Carson, which is a big oil refinery. Every time I drive the 405 down, I'm calling friends, trying to tell them where I am. I always say, yeah, I'm at the Blade Runner, you know, and or I'm at Los Angeles 2019. But it's raining with this insinuation that the world has become so polluted that it just rains all the time. And it, for whatever reason, is dark all the time, too. The world is largely the same in terms of you got people and you got police officers, and it just kind of goes, right? People in corporations that make a tremendous amount of money, like the Terrell Corporation, which is this gigantic pyramid structure that Sid designed, which is the headquarters. And one of the things that people miss all the time about the design of the Terrell Corporation is that there's these giant side buildings that are at a giant tilt, and they're not falling over. And so the big statement to an architect who sees the film is, oh my God, that building is 3/4 of a mile high, and it's not falling over. You know, it's not quite that tall, but it's really, really, really massive. I think the original scale was about a mile high, but they realized it would start touching clouds, respectively, so they pulled it back. But it's massive. The world has kind of messed itself up. And so most people that can afford it will go off-world. They'll live in different places. And they never really get into what that means. They don't get into, you know, planet Xeon or whatever. They don't say anything. They just say off-world, which is really nice. And so the people who are left behind are people who either like Earth the way it is, or they lack the resources or education, or they have health problems to leave the planet. Towards the end of the film, in terms of cinematic kind of nuances that are interesting, is that you have a lot of volumetric lighting, which means you drop a bunch of fog in a room and you blast a light through it. A couple things about that. You see that effect all the time today, but before Blade Runner, you rarely see that effect at all in any film at all in history until you go back to the 30s and you start getting some Casablanca, you know, third act scenes. The other Paul Harvey about the smoke was that the smoke that they used back in Hollywood in 80 to 82 was a very poisonous smoke. You weren't supposed to really inhale it much. But all these actors and, you know, people on set were inhaling this stuff constantly. And it was part of the complaints from the cast and crew that, you know, can we lay off this smoke because it's making everybody sick? And of course, Ridley said, no, it's part of the story. The other beautiful thing about Blade Runner is that you have a film with no special effects. The only thing you have are in optical printing effects, which is where we take a bunch of different film layers and expose them on top of each other to create a single shot. So, for instance, for any of you who've seen the film and you see the initial scene where Deckard is being taken to the police station at the beginning by Gaff, he's looking out the window and, you know, we're getting these incredible shots. So the lens flares, all of the reflections on the glass of the spinner has all been added after the fact. So they filmed it perfectly with no glass, and then they added all these special effects to give you the sense that he was traveling. And if you look at it and you look at how utterly seamless and beautiful it is, you're not losing contrast, all the usual flubs that you have when, say, George Lucas tried to put, you know, 200 TIE fighters flying around, you see the mats chasing them, you know. They did probably one of the most incredible jobs putting this film together in terms of optical effects. It's just phenomenal. But the film stands up over time. You can watch the old film, and it doesn't feel like you're looking at a relic. You know, there's when the spinners take off, you get a bit of a sense of they try to blow smoke out of the bottom of the, or they do blow smoke out of the bottom of the spinner, kind of indicating our propulsion system. And, you know, there's something about it just isn't enough smoke to really cause any lift. You just can't, you don't see any thrust, but that's really the only place where you really see anything that was strange. And there was a couple makeup flubs that were fixed in the copies of the film that you'll get today. But going back to the beginning, one more time. When you initially watched the film in 1982 in the movie theater, you have Harrison Ford who's narrating it here and there. It's really heavy narration at the beginning, loose narration in the middle, and heavy narration at the end, with an extra scene at the end that has now been clipped from the director's cut. Ridley Scott did not want to have Harrison Ford narrating this film. Narration to a director means that you've done such a poor job telling the story visually that you have to explain it to the audience. Now, I was about 12 years old. I guess I was 13 when the film came out. So, you know, it helped me as a kid. I don't know if I would have gotten it without the narration because I never had a chance. The end of the film is actually very interesting. And again, if you guys watch the making of in the DVD collection, a lot of this is just a repeat with a few things that I might know that you don't, but most 95% of it you're going to know because you've watched it on the suitcase selection or collection, excuse me. But when they saw the last scene that Ridley Scott filmed was Deckard closing the elevator at the end. And again, if you haven't seen it, we'll get to that briefly here, because I'm just going to give you the footnotes of the actual film in closing this episode to give you the kind of trailer of why you should see the original film. Again, it is so revered in Hollywood by everyone in the business, no matter what discipline you're in, special effects, directing, cinematography, acting, whatever, that you should see it if you like films and if you like that genre. There's nothing scary about it that you're going to have bad dreams or anything like that, unless you're scared of rain. But the studios had final cut, and that means that the director could decide when it was done. And if they wanted a change, you had to do it, otherwise they wouldn't release the film. Or they'd take it and cut it themselves, and that's the last thing you want them to do. In contrast, Kubrick always had final cut because he was such an artist and he had so much juice. He would say, "You don't get to distribute my film unless you agree to me having the final cut." That's how powerful that guy was, which is why he, again, was very unique. But at the very end, the studio said, "You got to put something else on the end here. It needs a happy ending, an uplifting ending." Deckard gets to leave with his woman, played by Sean Young. Rachel is the fictitious character's name. And so he was like, "What am I going to do?" And he goes, "Well, why don't you make a shot where they kind of get away in a car, they leave the dark city, and for the very first time they see wilderness and maybe some snowy ice caps and that kind of stuff." And Ridley's already going off. I believe he was filming Legend at the time, setting up all the pre-production for that. He's like, "I don't have time to come back to America and shoot something. So we can do a little bit of B-roll footage, and I'll film Harrison Ford and Sean Young inside a car, and then we'll just try to fledge something together." So the interesting thing was that Ridley Scott actually contacted Kubrick. And he said, "You know, I heard that your wife shot all the B-roll for The Shining as the little yellow Volkswagen, the Lemon, was going up the hill towards the Overlook Hotel. Do you have any of that footage that you didn't use?" And Kubrick was noted as saying, "Yeah, I got about 30 feet that I never used. You can have it. I'll have it sent over to you." And so when you see the original Blade Runner last scene, which, again, you could probably look it up on YouTube, you're looking at The Shining with this futuristic car that Sid designed, which was never really designed for broad daylight exposure, so it looks a little funky in broad daylight. But that's all they had, you know. But that was eventually clipped from the end of the film to leave it the way it was originally created, which is cool. Now, one of the notes that... I want to give like a Sid comment here. So Sid had done Star Trek 1. He did Tron 1. Now he did Blade Runner. He did the robot in Short Circuit. He did some of the pod designs in Aliens, the sequel to Alien. And he's just done tons and tons of stuff. Elysium and Tomorrowland. And he doesn't write the scripts. He just does the designs. But he's very, very famous for Blade Runner. And people come up to him all the time and ask him, you know, what is the most coveted thing you've ever done in your life, because you've done so much. And he says, well, obviously I love all the films I've worked on, but he said, you know, Blade Runner was probably the most fun because I had the most control over what was being put into the film. And he goes, the fabrication people just built exactly what I designed. And it was, there was no question about it being realized. Now, he did design a gun for Deckard that wasn't actually used, and I think the one they picked was actually better. But that's a very rare occurrence in Sid's design history. But sitting with Sid and talking to him several times about this over the years, his big thing is, he goes, you know, I designed the future so that people can see a positive potential for themselves. I don't design things that are dark because I don't want that future to exist. But he goes, Blade Runner is this weird sort of catch-22, in that one of the most entertaining things I've ever designed was a dark future. And so just know that even though it is a very dark film, dictated by the original book turned script, I think it's Hampton Fancher, not Fincher, that's his opinion about what he did there. So let's get into the footnotes of the script in case you've never seen this film before. The film starts out with a narration explaining to you the world you're about to enter, telling you that the world had actually developed these things called replicants. And when they are killed, they call it retirement. But in order to make sure that these androids, they keep getting better and better and better, they have versions which are called Nexus. Instead of using the word version, you use the word Nexus. So Nexus 1, 2, 3. So I believe we're dealing with the Nexus 6 series. And they are indistinguishable with humans. And they've been given something that Philip K. Dick invented, which is the notion of memories. And again, you see this all the time in movies now, okay? But the idea that you would give a robot memories such that it would be more stable as a being was really a Philip K. Dick invention, as far as I know. And there are I think Earl Hammer wrote the one for Twilight Zone called Dream the Body Electric, but it was based off of, I believe, an X-1 script, which Philip K. Dick wrote. And Philip K. Dick was a short story writer in the 50s and 60s, and so I think it came from him. Please correct me if I'm wrong, and I apologize, but I just saw some horror movie the other day in my smoke shop that was just it was a Bruce Willis film that was just the saddest attempt to copy Blade Runner you've ever seen in your fucking life. Unbelievable. And I like Bruce Willis, too. But the film starts out with our hero reading a newspaper against some, you know, neon-lit television shop. And across the way, he's waiting. It's raining like crazy, and he's waiting for a seat to come open in the sushi bar that's across the way. And the interesting thing about the sushi bar is that Americans really didn't know what sushi was, except for maybe in the huge cities. And so a lot of us learned about sushi by watching Blade Runner for the first scene. That's all you ever see. But he goes over and he sits down and he orders a couple servings of sushi. And then James Olmos comes behind him dressed in the wildest looking outfit you've ever seen. It's conservative, but it's cool. And he's all thin and young. And he starts speaking in, I think it's called city speak. And so you kind of understand a few words here and there. And he's telling him, you know, I want your attention, and you need to come with me right now, because sort of the chief of police wants to see him, Brian. He tries to resist, but then the guy says, I know you're a Blade Runner. You got to come with me right now. And Blade Runners are the agents that go out and retire replicants. But you can look at Harrison Ford and kind of go, well, he must have been doing this for a couple of, you know, decades at least. Because probably at least a decade, because he's in his like mid-30s at the time. But you know, with Harrison Ford, his sophistication, you can't quite lock him down, because his maturity that he plays can age him another 10 years, even though he looks good. And so he's kind of forced into this police car, the spinner. It takes off. There's a whole group of spinners, and they're going into this world. So now we get this huge vista of him going to the police precinct, where he then barges in the door, which is at the L.A. Train station downtown. They've kind of made a little room for him. And he essentially gets read the riot act that when I call for you, you have to come. Because if you don't participate in getting rid of these replicants, then you're sort of little people, and little people can get hurt. But if you remain part of our team, you get privileges, sort of. It's all in backhanded, beautiful metaphorical dialogue. So then he agrees to help, because he's kind of being forced to do it. And he gets inside this briefing room where he's being shown videos of everyone that escaped and survived, which are the four characters that I mentioned. Leon, Roy, Pris, and Zora. All of them are pretty much battle bots except for Pris, which is Daryl Hannah's, one of her first big roles ever, which is really cool. And to the credit of the actors, you know, you don't know you make a cult film until it becomes a cult film. And the whole arc of a cult film in most cases is it takes about a decade to become a cult film. It doesn't usually blow up like the Rocky Horror Picture Show, which just was made and immediately blew up as this thing that everybody worshipped, right? The only reason why I say that is if you ever hear criticism or get frustrated with how fast they adopted their roles, that's why, you know. But then the movie just starts out where he is going out and collecting facts about things, going to crime scenes. Actually, I think I just got ahead of myself there. There's actually one scene before this, what just happened, which is an interview with one of the replicants. Leon comes in and he's being interviewed by a Blade Runner at the Tyrell Corporation because they think that these folks would maybe try to go back and go to the company that they were made and try to get themselves fixed because they have four-year lifespans. And sure enough, they find one. And this cop named Holden, played by a brilliant actor, does an interview. And the interview involves this machine that Sid designed called the Void Comp Machine, which is to study the reaction of the pupil during certain emotional responses in relation to questions that a replicant may not know how to answer. Because as smart as they are, they don't really have all the memories that are the beautiful three-dimensional history of the whole thing. And during the questioning, it gets to a point where Leon basically loses his shit and blows away Holden under a table with this gun. It's about, looks like a little tiny gun that a woman might carry in her purse. I think it has about four barrels, but the impact is pretty much a 50 caliber round or something, man. It's massive. Then we flash to the scene I just told you. He goes to the precinct. There's a bit of a... He says, you know, why don't you put Holden on this case? And he says, well, he'll be okay as long as I don't unplug him. Basically meaning, I sent him over, he found one, and he got hurt. So, you've pretty much heard the setup that is going to cover everything that you need to see. The rest of the film is Harrison Ford going out and finding these four people. He also goes to the Tyrell Corporation and ends up meeting Dr. Tyrell, the inventor, the one that designs the brains, the one that designs the overall architecture of the Nexus line. And he befriends Sean Young's character, who's Rachel. He starts to fall in love with her. So he's trying to chase these four people that at first he's looking for them, and then he finds out they're looking for him. That sounds like a repeat, but it's not. First he's looking for them, and then he finds out they are looking for him, right? And you start learning about the fabric of this world through experience, and the J.F. Sebastian character, played by Sanderson, ends up mistakenly, serendipitously befriending Pris. But he's also one of the engineers at the Tyrell Corporation, so what the replicants try to do is go after all the employees to find one employee that can get them to Dr. Tyrell because they want to be saved. They want their four-year lifespan to be undone. And I'll just let you watch the film to find out what happens there. But there's a point where the humans start wondering, am I real or am I a replicant? And in the most kind of amazing turn of events in this particular film's history is that from the point the film released in 1982 to the point the film was remastered by Ridley Scott himself with fixes. They actually went in and fixed a few scenes where a stunt actress had to actually play a character at one point falling through some glass, and the makeup on her was really bad. She didn't look like the actress, and so they actually got back the actress in the 21st century here and dressed her up like she was and had her fall through the glass again. Now, she's 20 years older, but she's gorgeous, so you can barely tell, and really just did a beautiful job. They put all this together, and they re-edited it into the film and fixed this one spot in the film where it didn't look right. And there's a few little vignette scenes as well. I think they pulled off the director's cut and just stuck in there. So we, those of us who've seen the film hundreds of times, will see those new little vignettes, and it's just beautiful. But he did something that no one has ever done, to my knowledge, which is he changed the movie in a really big way. And if you haven't seen the film, I mean, most of you know exactly what I'm talking about, for those of you who are into it. But there's a... I'm trying not to spoil it for you. He went off and filmed the movie Legend with with Tom Cruise and the gentleman from Rocky Horror Picture Show, Tim Curry. And he took a scene from that film and inserted it into Blade Runner 25 years later, 30 years later. I think about 25 years later. And it changed what the film meant at the end. And I'll let you find out what that is. So there's no spoilers in this whole thing. I'm just basically giving you a glorified trailer with some of the sort of the reasons why this film is so revered among the people in Hollywood. I had the privilege of going to several screenings with Sid and the whole gang, and going to some talks with Ridley and that kind of stuff because of my working for Sid for years. And the people behind this film are utterly passionate about its creation. And I will tell you that of all the films that have made kind of cinematic history, this particular film has a family behind it that really care about it persisting and being polished. And you know, they remastered and up-res the original negative, so I saw it in this incredible theater that some of you have probably been to in Warner Brothers lot and here in Hollywood. But it just looked phenomenal, you know. But even the DVD crew that took care of the suitcase edition that you might see out there, you know, they treated the film like it was their film. And so the love that was put into this thing was really unique, I think, in history. And, you know, fans do participate in the recreation of things. You know, Doctor Who is probably one of the other series on TV where, you know, the fans resurrected some of the episodes back in the 60s that were lost using flash animation and audio tapes that they got off their TVs, and just tremendous, some of the followings that we have out there. Now, a couple little things that might be interesting. Now, some of you know this. Again, if you're diehard Blade Runner fans, there's only a couple things I've told you that you may not know. The very final scene, that sounds horrible. The final scene is between Rutger Hauer and Harrison Ford, which is Roy and Deckard having this moment on top of a building. And there was some beautiful dialogue written by the original writers for Rutger Hauer to speak, and he spoke those lines, but he also met with Ridley Scott before he did the scene, because they're all exhausted. They're about to lose their darkness, right? This whole film was filmed in the dark, so they had to film, you know, I think through the winter here in California, which, you know, we don't get snow, but it gets cold as hell out there. It'll chill your bones down, and we get really decent wind at the same time. And Rutger Hauer's up there in a Speedo, pretty much, almost like some sports shorts and a pair of shoes. And at least Harrison Ford's, you know, wrapped up in some clothing, but he's probably soaking wet at the time. But he said, "I've got some ideas for some lines that I'd like to add to the dialogue that I think really work." And Ridley Scott, who's a very, you know, forceful director because he has a very clear vision of what he wants, actually leaned in and said, "All right, You get it. After all this, man, you get a couple lines. Well, you know, we'll cut it if it sucks. We'll make you redo it again." But the last lines, which I won't even repeat so you can see them, just know that the last couple lines that Roy, played by Rutger Hauer, were written by Rutger Hauer on the scene, and it's some of the most beautiful dialogue you've ever heard. Sid has actually created a painting, which some of you might not know, that is, I believe it's called Shoulders of Orion. And for those of you who've seen the film, you'll know where that line comes from. So there's a painting that's actually a tribute to that final dialogue, which is, what did that look like? That's all I'm going to say. For those of you who know the film, what did the Shoulders of Orion look like? And he painted it. So you might want to look that up online. Hollywood used to make great films. And when I say great films, I mean films that just became sort of, you know, heirlooms to the family. If you owned, you know, if you had the watch from your great-great-grandfather in your left hand and the DVD of Blade Runner in the other hand, there was really no difference between the two back in the day. And what's interesting is in 1982, you have a flurry of films come out that it just would blow your mind. E.T. came out in the spring. And for those of you who missed that whole thing, you have people, you know, we were in E.T. world for a year or two. Like, we couldn't stop talking about it, you know, and no one owns E.T. anymore, right? It's not, you don't have to have E.T. in your house because it was made for kids and it was locked into a cultural moment in history where we were very innocent and positive, which is somewhere, you know, it's where we need to get back to. But you have Poltergeist and Dark Crystal and, you know, Tron and just a bunch of stuff. Go look up the movies released in 1982. And for my money and my knowledge of history, there is not a single year in Hollywood history where you have more blockbusters coming out in a single year than 1982. Now, I also want to mention just briefly to give some credit, because Sid did design a huge portion of the biggest set pieces, cars. Again, Gene Winfield, excuse me, did a beautiful job creating the cars. But there is a huge staff of folks that created the Chotskys, the swag, if you will, of the film. They created the gun that Deckard held and all the stickers and decals, and they created the sushi bar and all the neon signs, and they really busted their ass. So there is a huge design team that never gets mentioned, because there's a lot of folks that did it, that I actually had the privilege of meeting some of these guys during a presentation at Warner Brothers. And so there, you know, with all films, there are heroes stuck in the corners holding a light, holding a smoke machine, saving someone's life from falling. So any great film has a great crew behind it. And this film was littered with people that went through, you know, again, two financial upheavals before the film got done. You talk about a film that almost never got completed. It's one of those films. You know, it went an extra round that I know of. Wizard of Oz actually had the same thing too happen to him. I think they went bankrupt even more. The rumors are it went bankrupt like 5 or 6 times before that film got finished. But they were up against, you know, making the first color movie in world history, along with Gone with the Wind. But when it comes to using CMYK cameras all shooting at the same time, Wizard of Oz was definitely the first historical movie to start doing it. But it took so long to make the film and finish it and get it in the can that Gone with the Wind was able to come in and use the same technology and actually release in 1939 in the same exact year. But if you haven't seen Blade Runner, I seriously suggest you go see it. I find that females of a certain caliber really love the film. Usually older females will get into it more than younger females. But if you're sort of a sci-fi buff, you like lore, you like sort of complicated stories, up to a point, you will watch this film. And when someone whispers in your ear, yeah, this was made in 1982, there's only a few indicators in the film it was ever made in 82. And, you know, we didn't write for the need to have special effects. There weren't. You know, in Blade Runner, there's no CG bad guy, which if you guys are tired of that shit, you know, it's Marvel Civil War Part 25, you know, it's going to be a bunch of human actors with a bunch of CG overlay, and then there's going to be some giant beast that comes out of the toilet, you know, and rips apart Manhattan. The soundtrack that Vangelis eventually made, I think, is one of the most beautiful soundtracks of any film ever, and I will say that the soundtrack of that film is as close to the brainwave of Sid Mead that you could ever put into music. When I listen to that soundtrack, it's always Sid's world that I'm seeing, but it was actually Vangelis's world that he saw. They have a pretty good box set on iTunes, that you can buy. It's got some goofy little extra tracks they put in there where he's got his son having fun with his dad, but that's pretty endearing all into itself. So, again, get the film. I recommend the collector's edition where you can actually see the original version of the film with the narration and the last scene with the missing extra scene, and then go through all of the other DVDs. And again, most of you have already done this if you like the film. The other one is to go and download or read online the FAQ for Blade Runner, because after you've seen the film, you'll find that there are some interesting obsessions for the visual imagery systems that Ridley used. And I'll just say one of the fun ones to know about before you see the film is that there's an incredible obsession with eyes. And there's a lot of Masonic stuff too, because I believe Ridley is a Mason. And so there's a tremendous amount of architecture in the film. I shouldn't say tremendous. There's a fair amount of architecture in the film that relates to sort of the Mason symbolism. And the pillars in Dr. Terrell's office are very important homages to the Masons, in that when they were erected upside down on accident, Ridley walked in and said, "What did you guys do? Didn't you pay attention to the drawing? It's the other way around." And it's barely any difference, but there's a little bit of a width difference from top to bottom. Could have been either way. It wouldn't matter for us, but to people who are into that kind of thing, it's important, right? But the eyes, you know, there's this all-seeing eye at the very beginning, and we debate about whose eye that is. It's very interesting. So get into that if you want to have some fun, but only after you see the film. Seeing it twice would be the best way to do it. Watch the original, read the FAQ, and then watch the director's cut, and you'll have a blast. And then watch all the making of. But I'm glad to see that Harrison Ford's on board again. I'm very excited about seeing the sequel. Let's keep our kidneys crossed that it's worth our time. Ryan Gosling is probably the best guy you could probably put in there for now. DeepThoughtsRadio.com for all the feeds. You know it's a variety show. There's video if you're on audio if you're on video. There's a locked Facebook group. We are starting to get pounded by folks who are fake. So you got, you know, profiles that are 2 days old, a bunch of fake bullshit on them. So thank God we locked the group and got rid of the page. It's on iTunes, it's on Google Play, in the podcast form, in case you drive to work every single day. Maybe this will make the drive a little less boring. Anyway, that's it. Take care of yourself and someone else, and I'll see you in the next Deep Thoughts. Over now.